We're doing Parshat Vayeshev, and we'll try to go through the parsha quickly, trying to get an overall picture and then some depth. So it's just in 2 minutes summarize the parsha and then go over it with more depth. Our parsha tells us about the enmity between Yosef and his siblings. Yosef got special treatment from his father, and he had dreams in which he was indicated that he would rule over his brothers. And when he told over those dreams to his brothers, they hated him even more. And it happened that the brothers went out to Shechem, enemy territory. They just killed out the city of Shechem, and now they're going back there to graze their sheep. And the father is concerned, so he sends Yosef. And when Yosef comes, the brothers decide, there's the dreamer, let's kill him, throw him into the pit, and we'll say a wild animal ate him, and let's see what happens with his dream, with his dreams. And when Reuben hears it, Reuben says, "Now we won't kill him. Let's just throw him in the pit. We won't kill him directly." And his thoughts were to save him at night and bring him away. And when Yosef comes, they grab him, they tear off his special garment, and they throw him into the pit. And then they sit down to eat, and they see a caravan coming. And they decide they will sell him to that caravan. And he is sold down to Egypt as a slave, and over there he is purchased by Potiphar. And when they come back home, they show the father the torn garment filled with blood. They poured blood on it, and then the father thinks that he's being devoured by wild animals. So he sits there mourning, and they can't comfort him. And when they see that happening, they turn to Yehuda and they say, "You were the leader until now. Why, you could have told us not to sell him. Your fault." And they demote Yehuda, and Yehuda goes and does business. Says, "Vayered Yehuda me'et echav." Yehuda went down from his siblings, directly following the stories. And our tradition has it that the reason he went down from his brothers to do this business and married this woman and all that, that all happened as a result of the fact of the sale. Because it's juxtaposed. The Torah places this directly after the story of Yosef's sale. It says Yehuda went down from the brothers. That's the special trait of Yehuda, which we'll discuss, that when he's down and out, he's not down and out. He's building the future. The trait of Yehuda is to consistently have an eye on the future and always be planting seeds for the future. That's a trait of a real leader. There's no time that he's down. Even when you think he's down, he's not down. He's still building the future. That's Yehuda, and that's what we see in our parasha too. We see that about David HaMelech. David was counted down and out every time in his life. There was rarely a moment where he was viewed as the leader. From the minute he was born, where they had questions about how his mother got pregnant and they were wondering whether he was a bastard or not. And the brothers left him out in the sheep. He was the son that they didn't dream would have any future. That's what we say in Tehillim, in Hallel, Evin Ma'asu Abonim. This is the stone that the builders disgraced. No one thought it's a stone worthy of building with. Hayata L'Rosh Pina. That became the stone that was the cornerstone, the stone that you choose and that's your prize stone. Every stone is seen only from one side. The cornerstone is going to be seen from two sides. You have to take a nice stone to use as a cornerstone. Yeah, David HaMelech became the cornerstone, and everyone looked at him initially and said, "What a lousy piece of stone that is." That's an analogy, right? So David HaMelech says that about himself. Even Masu Abonim Ayeta L'Rosh Pina. David HaMelech also was counted down and out. And then on in his life, we'd have time to study it, we'd see that this was a reoccurring theme, that people didn't value him. Quite the contrary, they thought he was finished. Amru Elokim Azavo, after he sinned with Bathsheba, they said, "God must have left him. Nothing's going to be of David." All the time we see he was counted down and out. But let's continue with our parsha. Yehuda marries the daughter of Shua, a businessman. Here we see the word Kena'ani means businessman. And she has a son named Er, and another son named Onan, and a third son named Shelah. And Yehuda marries them off to Tamar, who is the daughter of the great Kohen Shem, right? The tzaddik, the son of Noach. Shem. He has a daughter named Tamar, who's pretty old, and she's marrying this youngster, but she's a righteous girl who wants to have a part of Yehuda's family. And Er is sinful in that he ensures that his wife doesn't get pregnant, and therefore God kills him. And then Onan also marries Tamar and ensures she won't get pregnant because he wants to maintain her beauty, and so he too dies. Now we see here the weight of this sin of one spilling one's seed and ensuring that one's wife doesn't get pregnant. And then Yehuda, who doesn't know the inside story, sees that Tamar is, her husbands are dying one after another. So Yehuda tells Tamar, "You wait around, Shelah's still young." And in his mind he figures, "I'm not marrying another kid to that woman." And God sees that Yehuda's wife passes away, and Yehuda is in a state of mourning. He finishes mourning, and he goes up to shear his sheep, which was a time of celebration. And Tamar hears that he's on his way north. He's going up to Timnas. And ordinarily in those days, a widow used to wear darker clothing. So she takes off her dark clothing. She gets all dressed up, and she sits in a place where she can seduce him. And Yehuda sees her, and Yehuda asks her out, and he doesn't recognize her. She has her face covered. And Tamar asks him, "What you gonna pay?" And he says, "I'll send you a goat from the sheep." And then she says, "Give me collateral." And she says, "Give me your signet ring, give me your staff, give me your fitilecha, whatever that is." And he gives him his special staff, his coat. He gives him his signet ring, and then she becomes pregnant. And then he sends the goat, and she's not around. And after 3 months, they discover that Tamar is pregnant. And in those days, that was considered improper. So Yehuda says, "Okay, we have to take her out to be judged." And they had a custom what they did with a woman who wasn't faithful. They'd brand her. Like they'd put she'd get a burnt mark on her forehead. That was a sign. That was the law of the time. I mean, it has nothing to do with the Torah. That was the law of the land of Canaan at the time.
If Yehuda had been demoted, then how come he was the one who made the decision that she should be taken out?
I guess it was the family's call. And as she was being taken out, and according to some understandings, she was taken out to be given the death penalty, and she didn't want to embarrass Yehuda. She sent word, "You know, I'm pregnant from the guy who owns these items." And Yehuda said, "You know what, she's right. I didn't give her Shelah, she's in the right." And then he marries her, and she has twins, and from those twins comes out the old Davidic dynasty. Yosef's taken down to Mitzrayim, and he's purchased by the chief executioner of Pharaoh, and he's very successful, and his wife, the executioner's wife, Potiphar's wife, wants him to commit adultery with her. He says no. She waits for a time that no one's around. She grabs him by his robe. He slips out of his robe, and he runs out naked to the street. And she calls out and says, "Look, look, look at what the guy tried to do to me." And I yelled. It's funny, no one heard her yell. And she tells the master, he has no choice. He puts Yosef in prison. Yosef's in prison, and over there he interprets the dreams of the two officers of Pharaoh's. His interpretation comes true, and one gets killed, another one gets replaced in his position as Pharaoh's in charge of Pharaoh's drinks. And now let's review the parasha with a little bit more depth. Her parasha begins with Vayeshev. Yaakov sat after all his troubles, running from his father's house, being chased by Laban, being chased by Esau, having all the arguments, losing his favorite wife of Rachel. Yaakov finally wants to settle down in peace. And God says, "That's not your job in this world. A person isn't supposed to look for a place where things are going to be peaceful and quiet. We have a job, we have to keep moving forward in the world, we have to build this world. And our job isn't to sit down." Now Yaakov was building, but he wasn't supposed to feel settled. And Yaakov has a son, two children that are orphaned, Yosef and Binyamin. And he gives special treatment to Yosef. Yosef's his orphan son. Yosef is the son that really he wanted. He never wanted the other wives. And when he makes a garment for all his kids, for Yosef he makes a ketonet pasim, a garment that has just a little ribbon of thread around the end of the sleeves. But you know what? If you have a little ribbon of thread, if everyone else has a blue blazer, and he has the blue blazer with the red mark around it, that's enough to get everyone jealous. And so our sages say from Yosef, we learn that even though a parent might have different feelings for his children, and that's natural, some children resonate with us, other children get on our nerves, we have to treat them equally. We have to be mind over matter. And children, that was a mistake, our sages say, that Yosef made a mistake. We were supposed to go down to Egypt, but it didn't have to look the way it did. Our sages say that when God makes a decree, there are many possible interpretations. The 400 years in Egypt could have looked very different than they actually did. And the reason they looked the way they did, our sages say, is because it all began with enmity. It began with improper treatment of Yaakov to his children, which caused hatred and jealousy. So even though we're dealing with great people, we're dealing with the Shvatim, and one might think when you're dealing with great people, I don't have to worry, they're going to be jealous, they're such fine people. Chazal say no, even when you deal with fine people, we have a halacha when it comes to a Kohen Gadol, that if a Kohen Gadol has to be demoted, so we don't treat the next, we have rules of how we treat a person when we have to demote him. We don't want jealousy. Even among great people, we have to be careful not to make jealousy. So that's one lesson we're supposed to learn from Yaakov Avinu. Yosef used to come home and tell his father, you know, someone moved your bed. I'll tell you who moved your bed. Reuven moved your bed. You guys know the story about his beds being moved. Right? So Reuven moved your bed when my mother died. He's the one that played the game. And Yaakov gets upset at Reuven. Mistake. Why is Yaakov accepting the tattletaling of Yosef? Yosef comes home and says, Dad, you know, they're not careful enough about waiting till the animal completely dies before they eat it. And Yaakov rebukes the children. Our sages say, mistake. What are you accepting Yosef's tattletaling? Maybe he didn't see correctly. Yaakov made a mistake in this respect, and Yosef made a mistake in this respect, and they both paid the price.
What was the curse that Yaakov gave to Rebekah?
He told him that he would lose his rights to the double portion, meaning his rights as a firstborn were taken from him and given to Yosef. We see Yosef became two tribes, Menashe and Ephraim, his two children, Ephraim. And that right should have been Reuven's. He also lost his right to the throne, meaning the throne should have come from Reuven, and instead it came from Yehuda. This isn't my shot, it says in Divrei Hayomim, in Chronicles. No, it was divided. There's a Mashiach ben Yosef. Let's continue. So, Yaakov has this special relationship with Yosef, and Yosef really is star pupil. Everyone learns by Yaakov, but Yosef catches on quicker, and he's getting all the secrets, he's getting it all. And the brothers see this, and they have hatred. And here we learn lesson number two. Sometimes you hate a person and you don't tell them I hate your guts. On the surface, you're very nice to him, and beneath the surface, you're ready to kill him. Chazal say an honest person is going to tell a person, I don't like you. He's going to be straight with him, and if he doesn't say it that way, at least he won't trick him. And the brothers, when it comes to Yosef, they're not playing games. They let him know that they're not happy with him. Yosef has a dream, and his dream, our sages say dreams can really be a form of prophecy. Assuming it's a person that's holy like Yosef, not a person like us whose dreams stem from indigestion. If we have a bad dream, our sages say, don't worry about it, just don't tell anyone. Chazal say, Chalma de lo mifarsha, a dream that isn't told over, ki igrita, is like a letter that isn't read. If you don't tell your dream, nothing bad will happen. If you're really worried about a dream, then we have a thing in the Siddur, you could bring together three friends, you tell them I had a dream, you read the thing in Hebrew or in English, tell them about your dream, and they read over, the dream should be good. That's called hatavat chalom, making a dream good. But in general, we say don't worry too much about dreams. But Yosef's dreams, we see they came true. Yosef has dreams, and we don't have time now to go into the dreams or how they experimented and saw the dreams come true. But bottom line, when he tells the brothers, they are concerned. Well, that's what you're dreaming about. You're going to be king over us. Twice he has the dream, and when he comes and tells his father the dream, his father says, what a nonsense. What kind of dream? You have a dream there that the sun and the moon are going to bow to you. The moon, your mother's dead. She's not bowing down to you. Obviously, the dream is false. Our sages say, Yaakov knew the dream was true. Because Yaakov was told by God, your nickname is Shemesh. Your nickname is sun. When it says, Vayizrachlo HaShemesh V'utzolech Al Yerecho, the sun rose for him. Our sages say, the sun over there in that pasuk is a reference to Yaakov himself. So when Yosef tells him, I had a dream and the sun was bowing to me, Yaakov said, oh, that's me. The moon either, Chazal say, just like you can never have pure kernels without some of the chaff in them, you always have a little bit of a psolet, something that's not real food among the food, so too you never have a dream that's all true. There's always some nonsense in a dream. So either the moon was just a nonsensical part of the dream, or else the moon was a reference to Bilo who raised him. A person who raises a child is considered like their parent. If you adopt a child, that child owes you. A child can't say, well, that's only my step-parent. What do you mean? Are they raising you? If they raise you, then you could even call them Ima. We see that Abaye in the Gemara was orphaned. He didn't have any parents when he was born. His father died while his mother was pregnant. His mother died when she gave birth. And Abaye often says in the Gemara, Amra li aim, my mother told me. Doesn't mean his biological mother. It means the woman who raised him. A person who raises you is like your parent. So the moon could have been a reference to Bilhah, the one who raised Yosef. Bilhah. That was one of the three wives that were left. She raised Yosef. Because Bilhah was the maid of Rachel.
Yeah.
Bilhah was the one who took over Rachel's place. She was the one that Yaakov put his bed by her. She took Rachel's place when Rachel died. So our tradition is that Bilhah was the one that raised him. But the first answer is that's our tradition. If you want the logic behind the traditions, I'm telling you. That's our tradition. Look in Rashi. Rashi quotes. The brothers go to graze the sheep. They're going to going on a vacation. So they go to Shechem. Now Shechem territory, Shechem's always been a trouble spot for the Jewish people throughout our history. And Yaakov is concerned that they went to Shechem. So he asks Yosef, could you go? And Yosef knows that he's in danger when he goes. But if his father asks him and his brothers might be in danger, he risks himself near his brothers just to see that they're okay. So he goes. And when he goes, his father accompanies him. And in accompanying him, his father teaches him a very important rule. We have a halacha called Egla Arufa in the Torah. You guys familiar with that? What's an Egla Arufa? The Torah says a special mitzvah in the end of Parshas, in the end of Parshas Shoftim, I think. It says if a person is found dead, and we know that he was murdered, and we don't know who murdered him, so we measure to the closest city. First we do a lot of research. We try to find out who the murderer was. We have no information. We try to find out who the person was, who might have killed him. We find out he was a stranger who was traveling. So we measure to the closest city, and that city sends an emissary to Jerusalem, and they say, you guys have to bring us rabbis from the high court out here. And then they take out the high court of that city, and they do a whole procession, part of which is la'arofes ha'egla, the part of which is slaughtering in a special fashion a calf. And then they say that blood should atone for us because we did our best to verify who murdered this person. And they make a whole procession. Now, what's the idea of this whole procession? Firstly, a person is killed just because you don't know who the murderer is. You don't say, well, what can we do? Let's bury him. No. Torah says you do a whole procession and you bring out the elders and bring out the elders from Jerusalem. First of all, you make a whole tadadum. You say, wait a second, something happened here. A human being died. Secondly, when you do such a taradam, the hope is neighboring cities will hear. This is something that happened once in a few hundred years. So people will hear, and then people will start talking about it. People talk about it, maybe the witnesses will hear. Maybe someone who heard something, saw something, someone will come forth and will get the information. So one of the things the elders say is, Yadeinu lo shachut adam hazeh. We didn't kill this man. So the Talmud asks, the elders are the people we were suspecting. The elders have to say, we didn't kill this man. What the elders are saying is, this man was closest to our town. We took care of him when he was in our town. We didn't let him leave without sending an accompaniment. We didn't let him leave without having the feeling that if he needed a place to stay, he could stay by us. If he needed something, we could help him out. We took care that our town is a hospitable town. We did our best. So from here we learn that when a guy comes and visits you, one of the halachas is you accompany him, you walk him 4 footsteps out. You give him the feeling that you're sad at his departure and that if he really needed a place to stay tonight, he could stay by you. So when a person leaves our home, part of Achnas Orchem is that we accompany him. When he leaves the city, we accompany him out of the city. So Yaakov, when Yosef is leaving him, Yaakov accompanies him. He walks him out. Hebron's on the mountain, it says he sent him from the depths. He walked him all the way down the mountain. He walked Yosef, he took care of his son. And he gave him the feeling, I'm with you. Don't feel alone. If someone starts up with you, I'm with you. Yaakov was teaching him the halachos of Egla Arufa, this calf that is slaughtered in this special fashion. Our sages say, when Yosef sends word back to his dad, Dad, I'm okay. What's the hint he sends back to his father? He sends back agalot. He sends back wagons and he tells the brothers, if Dad doesn't believe you that I became viceroy of Egypt, tell him the proof is, the last halacha you taught me were the halachos of Egla Arufa, that calf, that when a person leaves, you accompany him, and I'm sending you the wagons to accompany you up to Egypt. At this point, the whole Jewish history is about to change. When Yaakov departs from Yosef, the departing words that Yaakov gives Yosef are going to stick with him. They're going to be what holds Yosef when he's in Potiphar's house. You guys have to remember that. You send your kid off to college. Our sages say those departing words, that vision that Yosef had in his mind of his father, when the wife of Potiphar is holding on to him and saying, come sleep with me, the vision he sees is of his father. That's what holds him. Yosef leaves, and his father has accompanied him. And he comes to the city of Shechem. And God sends the angel Gabriel to meet him, and the angel gives him a warning. He says, you're looking for your brothers, they've left that. He says they've left that as though they've left this place, but he means they've left the brotherly love you're expecting to find. But his father sent him, so he goes. Okay, but it's reached a new level. And as Yosef approaches, so the brothers sit down and they say, what's he been trying to do to us? And they sit down and they convene a Bezdin. And they say, he claimed that we did things that we deserve the death penalty for. He came to our father and said, we ate from animals before they were dead, meaning we deserve the death penalty. He claimed that we did it, Reuben did improper things with the mother. He's not maintaining the Jewish tradition. Just like Avram had one son that was out of the fold, Yitzhak had one son that's out of the fold, obviously Yosef's not supposed to be in the fold. And they made it a grave error at that moment. But they came down, they sat down and they analyzed it, and they said, he doesn't deserve to be a part of the tribes. We'll manage 11 tribes, we don't need him.
They didn't consider themselves tribes.
They did. They knew they were the continuation. They were the continuation. And they thought, just like until now one could be cut out, so too now one could be cut out. So they sick the dogs at him. And the dogs, they don't touch Yosef. And Shimon and Levi turn to one another and they say, there's the dreamer, he's coming. Let me shoot him and we'll finish him off now. They pull the bow and the arrow and then they say, no, let's wait till he gets here. And when Yosef comes, the brothers have all agreed. They've come to communion and God has joined their Bezdin. They have only 9. God has joined and they've decided Yosef is not in the clan. So when Yosef comes, they tear off his clothes and Reuben says, don't kill him. Throw him in the pit here. So there's this deep, deep pit, and they don't see deep down inside, but deep down inside there are snakes and scorpions.
That's my question.
They didn't see. It was a deep pit.
But how do they know there were snakes and scorpions?
The pasuk says, Va'por reik, the pit was empty, ein bo mayim, there was no water. Vayeshvu lecho lechem, and they sat down to eat bread. If you read those words slightly different, it says Ve'yesh bo le'echol, but there were things inside that could consume Yosef. Habor reik ein bo mayim, and then the next pasuk says Vayeshevu le'echol lechem. So our sages say you could read that Vayeshevu as Ve'yesh bo, and there were in it le'echol things that could consume it. So Yosef is.
So you could interpret the pasuk two different ways.
Correct. Our tradition is that when you have a mi'ut achal mi'ut. When the pasuk says two words that indicate that you're supposed to detract from the understanding, so a double negative equals a positive. It could have just said, Aborek, the pit was empty. Why does it add, Ein bo mayim, there was no water, to indicate there was no water, there was something else inside. So I didn't know there weren't stones.
But it says, doesn't say it was empty.
It says, Aborek, the pit was empty. Look at, and then it adds, Ein bo mayim, there was no water.
So it was empty of what?
So it indicates there was no water, but there was something else inside.
Empty of, why does it just say it was empty of water? Why does it say it was empty? I mean,
the pasuk indicates
it was empty.
The pasuk tells us two things. From their perspective, it was empty, but the pasuk indicates to us there was something else there. So Yosef is down there, and he's completely frightened. Surrounding him are snakes and scorpions. And they're not touching him. And he wails and he begs them, don't do this to me. And the brothers don't listen.
Maybe on the other
hand. And Reuben tells him, don't do it. And they don't want to listen to him either. So Reuben goes off and he sees that he doesn't have the position of leadership. Why is he not the leader? Because he sinned with Bilhah. And he realizes the repercussions of his avera. When we do something wrong, sometimes we think, I did something wrong now. We don't realize the repercussions down the road. Now Reuben sees, now at this trying moment, he could be telling the brothers, don't do this, but they're not listening to him anymore. He lost his position. So he goes off and continues doing tshuva because he's gotten a new level of understanding to his sin. Yehuda's in charge. Yehuda lost it after the story. So now Yehuda's in charge. No. Yehuda's in charge now. And Yehuda tells the brothers, we're not going to make anything if we just let him die here. Yehuda thinks we shouldn't kill him. So Yehuda says, let's sell him as a slave. And Yehuda thinks if God wants him to be king, God will take care of him. So they pull out their naked brother from the pit while Reuven's out on a mountaintop lamenting before God, trying to figure out how he could do tshuva, because he realizes now that his sin has gotten much greater repercussions than he realized to begin with. And when they pull out Yosef from the pit, so Yishmaelim pass by and they see him and he's totally pale. The kid has just been facing snakes and scorpions, and they start bargaining. And they tell him, you know what kind of work this guy could do? And Yishmaelim say, we're not interested, a guy like that. Look at how pale he is, he can't do a thing. So they, by the time they're arguing, Midianites pass by and they're carrying all kinds of perfumes. And it's unclear who sold him. Meaning the Pasuk tells us different lines. At one point it says Yishmael, at one point it says Midianim. It's unclear whether the brothers sold him, which is our tradition, or others say that maybe while the brothers were haggling, the Midianim went behind their backs and they pulled him out of the pit and they sold him. It's unclear from the Pesukim who actually did the sale. But bottom line, he gets sold and he's taken down to Egypt. And he's sitting there in a caravan filled with perfume. And the perfume is an indication from God. Because ordinarily the Yishmaelim used to carry things like hides that stink. But God says, Yosef, I want you to know, you're going to suffer now for 20 years. But I'm with you. At a person's most trying moments, God sends him these small signs that he's still with him. So Yosef's being taken down to Mitzrayim. And when he comes down to Mitzrayim, there's a man named Potiphar, who is Pharaoh's chief executioner. And he sees a good-looking lad. Now Mitzrayim, women used to go with women. Lesbian and homosexual activity were rampant. And Potiphar sees a nice-looking young boy, and he figures, this is going to be very much fun. And he buys Yosef with one thought in mind and one thought only. Hashem sends the Malach Gabriel, who castrates Potiphar. And Potiphar comes home, and he finds himself unable to do anything. He's lost his manliness. And now Potiphar's wife isn't too pleased with him either. So Yosef is very successful in his home, and Potiphar's wife sees this great-looking young man, and her husband isn't giving, he can't produce. So Potiphar's wife calls over a bunch of women, and she tells him, I want you to know, I checked with my sorcery, I'm supposed to have kids from that young man. She was right. Her adopted daughter was the girl that Dina had when she was abducted by Shechem. When Dina was abducted by Shechem, she had a girl. She became pregnant from that time, and she had a baby girl. And the brother said, this girl came from an improper relationship. She does not stay within our family. And they sent her down to a good family in Egypt, Potiphar's family. And she had a locket. And on that locket, it told her her story. And she grew up in that house, and she's going to end up being Yosef's wife, that girl. That's the Osnat that she's going to marry. And Potiphar's wife, she saw, she had a vision. She was supposed to have kids from Yosef, but she saw incorrectly. She was supposed to have grandchildren from her adopted daughter. And Potiphar's wife calls over her friends, and they're peeling citrons, estrogim, and she says, I want you to know, you're going to see that it's not easy for me. Every day I see this good-looking young man in our house, and every day I can't contain myself. So her friends say, it can't be that bad. She says, I'll prove it. And as they're slicing the estrogim, she calls Yosef in. And as she calls Yosef in, they start cutting their hands. They're so taken by his beauty. And she says, I told you. I told you. They look down, they've cut their hands. She says, you see? And I have to live with this every day. So she tells Yosef, look at me. And Yosef won't look. And she says, I told you to look at me, young man. He says, I'm not. I am a God-fearing person. I won't look at you. So she tells her husband, I don't like the way your servant is behaving. I want you to put a knife under his chin so he can't keep putting his head down. And the foolish Potiphar does. And now Yosef has no choice, but he looks the other way. He won't look at her. He knows that the beginning of sin is where our eyes go, that's where our thoughts go, that's where our heart goes. So Yosef won't look at her. And she tries. Potiphar calls him in one day and says, why do I always see you moving your lips? What kind of sorcery are you doing in this house? Yosef says, I'm praying to God. You see, check all the books. I've never done anything improper with you. All my books are honest. Why am I honest? Because I'm a God-fearing person. Don't tell me to stop praying to God. That's what I do, even though I'm your slave, but let me do it. Potiphar sees he's honest. So Potiphar puts him in charge of his home, and our sages say that was an error. If you don't want your wife cheating on you, our sages say, learn from Potiphar. Don't leave hired help walking around the house. Even though a person's wife could be the greatest person in the world religiously, Potiphar's wife was a pious woman. She wasn't a sinful person. But she had this guy walking around the house all day, and our sages say, the most pious Jewish woman. It's not fair to put her in that situation. You don't want your wife to be cheating? Don't put a guy around the house. Don't leave a guy in charge of the house. Chazal say that as advice for us. So the day comes and the Nile is supposed to rise, and the priests always used to run the calendar. They knew when the Nile would rise. They said they controlled the Nile. They tell everyone to go out to serve the Nile. Potiphar's wife sees that Yosef's a God-fearing person and she buys into it. She says, what am I going to go pray to the Nile for? She tells everyone, I'm sick. So everyone goes out of the house. Yosef says, I don't pray to the Nile. Yosef's around and she's around. And Yosef comes home. And when Yosef comes home, she grabs him and says, now's the time you're going to be with me. And Yosef says, no, it's wrong. And Potiphar's wife says to him, Yosef, tell me, have you never sinned in your life? Yosef, think about it. Be honest with yourself. What are you making yourself to be such a pious person for? You've sinned. You know that God knows you've sinned. You're not perfect. So one more sin. What's it wrong? What's wrong? One more time. Think about it. A young man, he's there all alone. His family has kicked him out of the house. For all he knows, he has no portion in the God of Israel, because where's God been? Here he's suffered at his own brother's hands. He's lost his mother. He's been orphaned. Life's been so difficult. He could have just thrown it out and said, yeah, let's go. What's wrong? Who's going to know? He says, no. I fear God. What does Yosef say? There's no one greater than me in this house. I am the most God-fearing person and I'm not going to give in. Sometimes when we're faced with the Yetzer Hara, what we have to say is, no, I am tops. Sometimes the Yetzer Hara comes and says, just do what's wrong. And sometimes the Yetzer Hara tells us, what's your worth? Be honest with yourself. Wait, how many mitzvahs have you done? How many averes have you done? What's one more? And that's what Potiphar's wife tells him. She grabbed his clothes. That's one understanding. What does boged mean? Traitor. She grabbed him at where he was a traitor and said, Yosef, who are you kidding? You've been a traitor before. You haven't lived up to all the mitzvahs. What brought you down here? Come on, one more time. And Yosef refuses. Now the story began before this. Yosef made a mistake, which was a mistake for anyone but Yosef. Yosef turned to God and said, God, you tested my grandfather Avram, and he lived up to your test. You tested my grandfather Yitzchak, and he lived up to your test. You tested my father Yaakov. I want to live up to something. You're not giving me any tests. That's a mistake. We never ask for tests. David HaMelech asked for a test and fell. But Yosef says, God, why am I not having any tests? Now here we get perspective. Yosef could have said, God, how many tests have you given me? I lose my mother, I lose my brothers, everyone hates me, I'm in a country where I don't speak the language. It's not what he says. He's in Potiphar's house, and he recognizes, I have clothing, I have shelter, I have what I need, I'm not dying. God, you're not testing me. That's a tzaddik's perspective. So God tells him, I'll give you a test. That's bigger than everyone else's test. You want a test? Oh, I'll give you a test. When we ask for tests, God give it. God gives it. And Yosef lives up to the test. Yosef HaTzadik. He's the only one of the tribes we call Yosef HaTzadik. Because when he's a young man and he's got all the desire burning within him, he knows, no, I won't do it. How does he live up to the test? Because every one of us knows that there is a moment before we sin that our mind says, I shouldn't do it. And our desire says, I want to do it. And at that moment, we're in control. And the question is, will we grab the moment? And will we say, I am in control and I will run my life? Or do we say, my desire will run my life? I'll be like every animal in the field. Yosef grabs the moment. Yosef says, I will not fool. Now, sometimes when we live up to a test, we expect, you know, I did what's right, God. Where's my payback? Yosef does what's right. And what happens? All of Egypt starts talking about him. Oh, he tried to be an adulterer. You see those Jews? Look at him. His master gives him everything he could have asked for. And what does he do with it? He tries to cheat with the master's wife. Yosef could have turned to God and say, God, you know, I did what I was supposed to do. Why is everyone saying this about me? The rule in life is when you stand up to a test, God says, okay, here's another one. God doesn't say, you've lived up to it. Okay, I'll make it good for you. God says, good. What did I put you on this planet for? To grow. I'll give you another opportunity to grow. We have to get used to this concept that in life we're here to grow. The Western culture keeps giving us this story of they lived happily ever after. In Judaism, we don't believe in such a concept. Not in this world. No such thing as they lived happily ever after. Happily ever after means you keep growing. So Yosef is given another challenge. And unfortunately, we are out of time.